Hi, this is Craig Hirsch, and welcome to the Family Estate and Legacy Program podcast.
So when is an irrevocable trust not really irrevocable? Well, let's talk about this. There is something that you can grant your beneficiaries in your trusts called a power of appointment. Now, what's that? So let's say that in my trust, it says that at my death, my trust continues on for my wife. My wife's name is Patty. She's my primary beneficiary. So the trust continues on for Patty for the rest of her life. And then at her death, my trust terminates and is distributed to my three daughters. And I have three daughters. Their names are Gabrielle, Courtney, and Madison. So typically a marital trust might look something like that, that the trust continues on for Patty and then terminates. Now, let's say that I died sometime soon. Hopefully I don't, but let's say I died sometime soon. And Patty survives me by 20 or 30 years. Well, if my trust becomes irrevocable at my death, and typically it does because a revocable living trust requires the person who creates a trust, that would be me in my case, to amend the trust. So if I'm no longer competent or I am no longer alive, I have no ability to amend my trust. So let's say that I died, and let's say 10 years later, one of my daughters develops a drug habit. Or let's say that sometime between my death and my wife's death, one of my children, God forbid, dies, and they have children who become beneficiaries in their place. And let's say one of their beneficiaries has a problem. You know, they have a disability where they're receiving Medicaid, and to receive the inheritance, it would disqualify them from the government benefit. Or they have a another problem, or maybe they have a drug problem that we wouldn't want them to get a lot of money, or they're too young to get a lot of money, or there's any number of circumstances where my wife would want to adjust my trust between the time of my death and the time of her death. But because I'm no longer around, my trust is irrevocable and that becomes impossible. That's where this power of appointment comes in. I can grant my wife a power of appointment and I can limit it. I could say she has a limited right to amend the trust as it exists between our beneficiaries, you know, our descendants. We could include charities because if we have taxable estates and we want to minimize the tax, we want to include charities. We could include spouses of our children. So we can limit the class of beneficiaries that my wife could reappoint the assets. Typically, we wouldn't want her to reappoint the assets to a new spouse. So if I died, my wife remarries, we would not want her the ability to give it to a new spouse because if he survives my wife and then leaves it to his children, then my children effectively become disinherited. So typically when you're giving a power of appointment, you limit the class of beneficiaries that your appointee can use. Now, why would you want to do this? As I said, you know, we've given you various reasons. Well, why wouldn't you want to do this? Well, that could mean that, for example, my wife, if she had a fight with one of my children, she could decide to disinherit them from my trust, not only her trust, but from my trust. Let's say I'm deceased, she gets in a fight with Gabrielle, and she decides that she's going to eliminate Gabrielle as a beneficiary and give everything to Courtney and to Madison. Now, I probably would not have wanted that. So when you're granting a power of appointment, you want to make sure that you've discussed it with your beneficiary who is going to hold that power of appointment, how you would want them to act. You want to trust that they're going to act the way that you would have acted. Now, this is more problematic, for example, in second marriages, where there are children of the husband's prior marriage and children of the wife's prior marriage. Giving powers of appointment can be quite dangerous because we might find that the beneficiaries that we hope for would be disinherited. Now, we can grant powers of appointment not only to our spouse, but to our children. So let me give you an example. So on the survivor's death, or the death of the survivor of Patty and I, our trusts divide into three different shares, one each for Gabrielle, Courtney, and Madison. But aside from the shares being distributed outright, what happens is these shares continue on in trust for Gabby, and there's another share for Courtney, and another share for Maddie. Now, we do this to provide for protections, protection from divorce, protection from creditors, protection from taxes. There's any number of reasons why you would want the trust to continue on for your children or even your grandchildren. And the same holds true with this power of appointment. If you don't grant a power of appointment, then upon your death, the trust actually becomes irrevocable. And a lot can happen over time. a lot can happen where, you know, between my death and my daughter's death, you know, that's a whole generation. So typically when you leave trusts that continue on for the next generation, as there are very good reasons to do so, as I just pointed out, there's also a very good reason to give the power holder, to give the beneficiary, the right to make changes to what you originally had. And these are all ways that you can make what is otherwise an irrevocable trust revocable. Now, there's one more point that I want to make, and that regards the different types of powers of appointment. I've already talked about a limited power of appointment. That is where you limit the class of beneficiaries over which the beneficiary can change who the ultimate beneficiaries will be. You can limit it, as I said before, the typical limitation is for descendants, spouses of those descendants, and charities. Now, there's something called a general power of appointment. Now, what's that? The general power of appointment is used when we want to avoid something called the generation skipping transfer tax. It is a power of appointment where you don't limit the class, or if you do limit the class, you have something called a defective general power of appointment. It's intentionally defective. You go, why would I want my attorney to draft something that's intentionally defective? And the idea behind it is it includes the assets in the estate of the beneficiary. In my case, let me give you an example. Let's say I create a defective general power of appointment to my daughter, Gabby. The defective part would be that she can only appoint to her creditors. Now, why would she do that? She wouldn't. She would never appoint the estate to her creditors. But in so doing, under the tax code, it becomes a general power of appointment. As a general power of appointment, what happens? Well, the assets of the trust are included in her estate for federal estate tax purposes. Why would I do that? Because if I failed to do that, if I had too much money, then it could actually subject the assets to this generation skipping transfer tax, which is a penalty, and it is assessed on top of the estate tax. So sometimes there are reasons that we want to do this. It's a little bit beyond the scope of this podcast. But what I want you to take away from this podcast is that these powers of appointment can be used so that the family can adjust the trust even after the person who created the trust is gone, and they can adjust it as the family situation warrants, but it also requires a great deal of trust in the person that you're granting this power to, and you probably want to have discussions with them and conversations with them as to why you did what you did and how you would like to see them actually exercise a power of appointment if that should arise, if that need should arise. So I hope that this podcast provides you some confidence and clarity. We look forward to speaking with you soon.